Ah, picked the right time. Questions?
What's the meaning of life?
42, isn't it?
Yes.
So, a couple of words about the homework. I'm sure your calculator's been feeling lonely, so nice to have some real numbers to work on. So that's kind of the plan, actually crank out some real numbers with real data, which leads to, of course, unit conversion and all of that sort of fun stuff that we haven't worried a whole lot about. And actually, probably don't want to use your calculator on this. A lot of this is perfectly set up to deal with in a spreadsheet. So if you look at the units that are listed in the upper right-hand corner for the dipole moment, you might be worried. The dipole moment is in ESU, stat coulombs, centimeters. What's an ESU? So stat stands for static. So actually, that one I give you the conversion in the online assignments file. But I wanted to talk a little bit about these ESUs, which, and EMUs for that matter, electrostatic unit, electromagnetic unit. So these are kind of an alternative system for electricity and magnetism. And it has no relationship to voltmeters or ammeters or any sort of practicality. The reason for these units is that they make the equations look easier. And so theorists love them because you don't have to write so many 4 pi epsilon naughts. So basically the logic is, Coulomb's law says that the force is 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught. Take the product of the charges and divide it by r squared. And basically what we did is we invented a unit for charge, and then we had to get rid of the unit for charge in order to get forces out. So why bother? Right? Why not just write this as the product of the charges divided by r squared? And have these Qs, instead of inventing a new unit for coulombs, have these Qs have whatever crazy units are necessary in order to get you, I'll say newtons, but actually not newtons, out for your force. Right. So, I mean, get rid of all these 4 pi epsilon naughts, and the price is we're going to be measuring charges and currents in things that have units like the square root of centimeters times grams or something like that. But who remembers the units of epsilon naught, right? I guess it probably is in Little Green Book. So that's kind of the plan for this alternative system of units, which is sometimes called Gaussian. It was more common in the past, but still, as I say, theorists love it. Since it's totally unrelated to voltmeters and ammeters, it's not real popular among engineers. And it's actually set up, instead of using System International Units, MKS, it's set up for the centimeter gram second system. So when I said the force was going to be in newtons, it's actually going to be in dynes, which is the a gram centimeter per second squared in the CGS system. Okay, so we're never going to use this system. The conversion constant to relate the ESU centimeters into Coulomb's meters is in the book, so you don't even have to look it up. But you should be familiar with it. It will occur in books because it makes the equations look simpler. And it's basically always used when people are doing complex calculations. Okay, so what we've got then is this little inserted problem, number 3, which is more Fourier's trick practice for when we have dielectrics present. And it's made unnecessarily complicated so that we've got lots of things going on. So we actually have free surface charge on top of a dielectric, a situation that probably never occurs in nature, but makes nice problems. If you look online, there are also problems that have to do with finding the force between a charge and a dielectric, and that should be just write it down, right? That at this point, if you know the image charges, you should be able to write down what the force is, but sometimes people have problems with that, so I made it into a problem. And then there's another problem that has to do with very explicitly dealing with these boundary conditions, namely that the change in the normal component of D is given by the free charge density and the tangential component of E should be continuous. So basically it gives you numbers for what E and D are on one side of the boundary, and you're supposed to calculate what E and D are on the other side of the boundary. Just to be specific with numbers as opposed to taking derivatives of things and maybe forgetting that there are numbers involved. Okay, so lots of numbers this time. I only have a few of these sorts of exercises where you get to use your calculator. Questions? Okay, so what did we talk about last time? So the kind of basic idea is that we spent the first cycle or so developing methods for dealing with finding electric fields and voltages in a vacuum. And in fact, usually you're interested in finding those things in materials. So instead of redoing everything, we found out that there was an equivalent formulation where we could have the equivalent of charge from the minus divergence of the polarization, and we can have surface charge density. And then we looked at how to use boundary conditions in order to match those things up. And in particular, for linear dielectrics, the bound charge density, rho b, was proportional to the free charge density. So if the free charge density was zero, which is a pretty common situation, then we could still use Laplace's equation. And all we had to do was connect things up using boundary conditions. And most commonly, we're going to use that the voltage has to be continuous. That's the same thing as saying that there's no change in the tangential electric field, and that the change in the D field is given by the free charge density, which very commonly is zero. So what we did is we worked the problem of a dielectric sphere that's in a previously uniform electric field. And a lot of this sets up pretty much like normal. In general, we would have A terms and C terms, but we realize that there can't be any C terms because nothing's going to go to infinity at the origin. Theoretically, we could have A terms and C terms outside, but generally speaking, we don't want the voltage to go to infinity with the exception of what's necessary to make the constant electric field, so most of those A terms went to zero. So then the boundary conditions were that if we evaluated this function at the boundary and we evaluated that function at the boundary, we had to get exactly the same thing because there's only one voltage at a single point. And then we could line up the coefficients of Pn on either side of the equation. They had to be equal, just as if vector A equals vector B, the x component of both of those vectors have to be the same. And finally, there's no free charge, so there's no change in the normal derivative of the normal D field, which is radial on this point. So we get the electric field, and we multiply it by k epsilon naught in order to get D. Epsilon naught has canceled out on both sides of the equation. And we got another equation that we related these two. Now, the equations I've written down for the unknowns A and C are inhomogeneous. That is to say, there's a constant term in addition to linear factors. The other equations we would write down, for example, for A2 and C2, would turn out to be homogeneous. That is to say, they would have a constant term that is zero. So we've got this mantra, which we're going to be using lots of times, that if we have homogeneous linear equations, then there's a trivial solution, namely the x and y, the unknowns, are both zero. And unless the determinant is zero, that is the unique solution. And we're guaranteed uniqueness. So we usually don't even bother to check that the determinant is zero. Okay, so the upshot of all of this work was this sort of picture. When we put the dielectric sphere in the constant electric field, it polarized. and therefore there was a bound surface charge positive on this side and a negative charge here. There was no volume charge density because the divergence of the polarization had to be zero because there was no free charge density, right? We set up here that if there's no free charge density, then there's no bound charge volume density. So we had the problem then of this dielectric sphere. And what we found out is kind of no surprise. If we have positive charge here and negative charge there, it's going to make an electric field that's pointing in the opposite way as the outside electric field. So the electric field gets reduced to that particular value. Outside, in addition to this constant electric field, there's a dipole field. And it's equivalent to a point dipole. And if you rework the equation, this is exactly what you get for the multipole expansion, for the point dipole that is also present. And it makes perfectly good sense, because what we have is the electric field inside times the susceptibility times the volume. So the electric field times the susceptibility gives us the dipole moment per volume. And if we multiply that by the volume, we're going to get the dipole moment. So it all makes perfect sense. Questions? So the other problem we didn't really work fully was kind of a crazy concern, maybe at least at first sight. What is the force on a charged particle that's in water or something like that? You know, since 200, you've known that the force is the charge times the electric field. But it's a little bit less clear in a dielectric, because there's going to be new sources of electric field from the polarization of all of this dielectric material. And that's going to mean that the electric field isn't the one that you apply. It's in part what you apply, but there's also all this other electric field. So if push comes to shove and we actually calculate what the force is on this guy, is it going to be the obvious answer, just Q times the electric field? We didn't really have to so we worked a similar problem where we had a conducting sphere not in a dielectric, in vacuum. And of course, the electric field was modified there too, but it was modified because of charges that were on the conductor. And of course, you can't push yourself, so however those charges are modifying the electric field, it can't push the conductor forward. But here we have charge that's not part of the conductor, namely the polarized dielectric, and maybe that's going to change the formula for force. So what we concentrated on was actually this kind of funny factor that comes in the end. And that is, when it comes time to calculate the force, we're going to take the electric field times the charge, which is all on the surface, of course, so it's a free surface charge density. And suddenly this 1/2 appears out of no place. And we made a couple of arguments for understanding why that 1/2 was there. One way of thinking about it is that it's the average. So what we have is electric field, surface charge, zero electric field. So what is the electric field where the charge is? And you know, one kind of common sense idea is, well, it's going to be the average of zero and whatever it is outside. And of course, if you average zero and x, you get x over 2. If you don't like that argument, you can talk about the fact that we want to get rid of the piece of the electric field that is due to the charge itself, because you can't push on yourself. And it turns out that if we make that sort of argument, inside the conductor, the surface charge is making an electric field that's down. The external charges have to be making a canceling electric field. So the external electric field just has to be half of what it is on the surface. So you can pick your favorite argument for why there's that 1/2. But there is a 1/2 there. In terms of kind of the mechanics that the book would go through to solve this problem, it's all pretty much the usual thing. Outside, we're going to have a constant electric field term, but otherwise, we're going to have things that are going to go to zero. We haven't seen this term very frequently before, because we've been dealing with uncharged things. But now this guy has some charge, and so there better be some, you know, at great distances, 1 over r potential and 1 over r squared force. Okay, so we haven't written that term before because things were uncharged, but this guy is charged, so we better write it. And of course, we know that the voltage on the surface of the conductor is going to be a constant. So we go through all of the usual work, and we can calculate what the, by the usual boundary conditions, we can calculate what the electric field is just outside the conductor, and from that we can get the free charge density, and then we just need to do this integral to get the force. And of course, I hope it's clear that there's only a radial component of the electric field. There can't be a tangential component of the electric field because the tangential component has to be continuous and at zero in the conductor. And if you think about it, then the z component of the electric field to get the z component of the force is just that radial component times the cosine of phi. If we wanted the x component of the electric field to get the x component of the force, there would be ER sine phi, sine theta cosine phi. And you know that the average value of cosine phi going around the sphere is going to be zero. So that's why, I mean, it's pretty obvious that there's no x and y components, but that's the mathematical reason why there's no x and y component for this guy. Just a force in the direction of the electric field. Okay, so we didn't go through the details. The details are in the book. I wanted to concentrate on that kind of funny one half, which kind of pops in out of no place. So those were all Fourier strict sorts of methods. Another method we learned to solve problems was image charge methods, which kind of seem like magic. The plan is to come up with some charge distribution whose voltage we can calculate and make it work, to make it satisfy the boundary conditions. And what usually seems a little bit funny about this problem is we start talking about the voltage equation that we're going to use on this side and the voltage equation that we're going to use on that side of the boundary. That kind of never cropped up before. But it was always there, right? So we had the voltage outside the conductor as being some formula. We never bothered to concentrate. There was a totally different formula for the voltage inside the conductor, namely zero, right? It was pretty dull. Well, now the voltage isn't going to be zero on this side, so we really do need an equation for what the voltage is going to be when we're on that side. So we've got a set of images that apply when we're trying to figure out what the voltage is in region one, and we've got a set of voltages of image charges that we're going to use when we try and figure out what the voltage is in region two. And it's not fundamentally different, but it kind of looks different because in the past, this one was so trivial that we never really bothered to write it down. Okay? So it was just a matter of applying the boundary conditions then, right? The voltages had to be the same on this boundary between 1 and 2, and the D component had to be continuous across this boundary because there was no free charge, and we eventually got these equations for what this image charge is and what this image charge was and the corresponding notions for voltage. Okay, any questions on all of that? Going. Okay, so on to chapter 5. So for chapter 5, we're kind of taking a different approach. So I hope that all of this class has looked like a lot of mathematics, which, you know, is maybe a little bit worrisome. So here we're actually trying to figure out what's going on inside the dielectric. What's the physics, as opposed to the mathematics of how a dielectric works. And generally speaking, this is the area of physics that would be called condensed matter physics or solid state physics, how materials actually work. And the kind of starting point for this is the overall plan is we have this this block of dielectric. So here's a hunk of dielectric. And I've been trying to shade these guys green, but sometimes green was copper. Okay, so this is actual material, it's not vacuum. And I'm gonna be interested in a atom that's in amongst all of these other atoms. And we're gonna be interested in what electric field this guy sees. And we already talked about this electric field that we've been calculating in the dielectric is a little bit of a strange idea, because the electric field is hugely different when we're next to an atom or when we're away from an atom, and it's kind of some sort of average. But now we're asking, what is the electric field that an atom sees? And it's going to turn out not to be this E that we've been calculating. It's going to turn out to be something else. So the plan for dealing with this is to take out a spherical chunk . Get rid of that chunk of dielectric, and inside, instead of having continuous material inside that chunk, let's think about the individual atoms that are making up the neighboring particles. Okay, so if we think about it, the electric field we're going to calculate is going to be the electric field that we've been calculating, the usual electric field in the dielectric. So let me label this E sub n. That's going to be the electric field that the molecule sees. Then we want to subtract off the piece of this that's due to this hunk, right? So contrary-wise, we have this hunk of material, polarized material. What's the electric field that this guy has? We want to subtract off that. And add in, instead of thinking about this as being a continuous piece, add in the electric field caused by all of these individual molecules that are surrounding our molecule. Okay, so this whole process is only going to make sense if this match radius, in fact, doesn't matter in the end. Right? It would be very worrisome if we get an answer that depends on how big a piece we take out and replace with individual atoms. So it better not do that. So this minus, so that's the electric field that is caused by our interpretation of that continuous hunk. So this polarized sphere, it would produce an electric field by itself, which is in fact due to individual molecules. But we treated it as a continuous object. So let's subtract that off and instead add up the electric field due to all of the surrounding molecules.
So that second E is different.
A little bit louder.
So the second E is different than the first.
Yeah, they're all E's, but they're different. So this is the E from the dielectric sphere. And this is the E that we've been calculating, the so-called macroscopic E. And it's also, it's the E we would calculate using the techniques we've talked about. So it's actually kind of the average E. And this one here is the one that the molecule sees. Okay, and this would all have no point, of course, if the electric field that we've been calculating is the same as the electric field that the molecule sees. So it better not be the case. Okay, so material is actually made out of atoms, but it's complicated to actually calculate the electric field due to all of these atoms. So we treat the parts of this dielectric that are distant as a continuous object in order to get this. We subtract this piece of the continuous object and we replace it with the actual electric field due to these molecules. Okay? And this is something that we've solved. Right? The electric field due to this polarized object, if this guy has a polarization that is that way, we know that the electric field is in the opposite direction, and it has magnitude P divided by 3 epsilon naught. And if you don't believe that, So this is the electric field. So if we have a uniformly polarized sphere, it produces an electric field that's in the opposite direction of the polarization and has that magnitude, right? And so this is from two lectures ago, right? So there it is, where we worked the problem of a polarized dielectric, and there's what the electric field is. Okay? Okay, so we have kind of minus a minus. So this what we've got then is the macroscopic electric field plus the polarization divided by 3 epsilon naught plus this sum of all of the atomic E's. Okay, so this is pretty tricky to calculate, right? So we're going to go a macroscopic distance, say 10 micrometers around our atom, and we're going to add up the electric field due to all of the atoms that are surrounding it. And the nice solution when you reach a tough problem is to give up, right? When things get rough, the smart just take the easy way out. But of course, is that true? Well, how about some circumstances? If you think about it, if the atoms are randomly arranged, there couldn't be any order to the electric field that they create. If we think about the following calculation, and I don't think I'll bother to do it, if you think about a spherically symmetric distribution of dipoles, so imagine taking a dipole and spreading it out, keeping its direction fixed, spreading it out all over this sphere. It turns out that at the center of the sphere, it makes no electric field. So if the dipoles are, even if they're polarized, if they are spherically symmetric, then they're not going to make an electric field at the center. But you do have to be a little bit careful, because maybe things aren't exactly the way you might think. So let's write down the equation for the electric field that we would have from a single dipole. I'll try and get it right. So I wonder if I've got a sharper one of these. So the electric field from a single dipole and I'm putting that dipole at the origin, kind of as usual, 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught. And then we had this kind of funny stuff, r hat dot p, oops, not p hat, p, in the r hat direction, minus p divided by r cubed. Okay, so that was the formula we've had a few times for what the electric field is from a point dipole. So if we're here and we have a little point dipole here, what is the direction of the electric field that it's going to make for us? So this r hat vector points from the dipole to us, so it's pointing down. But there are two of them, so if we work that out, it's going to be just in the p hat direction. So this is going to be 3 p hat minus p hat. This is going to make a vector that is up, that has, aside from the r squared factor, it's basically going to be up of 2p. How about if the dipole is below? Well, again, all we've done is reverse the direction of r hat, and r hat is there twice. So, you know, minus squared is 1. So it's actually going to also produce 1 that's up. So these two guys that you might think cancel, in fact, add. So So I don't know, maybe not. How about one that's over here? So now our hat dot P is zero because we're perpendicular. So this is going to make one that's down because of that minus sign, and it's going to be P. So maybe we can have some cancellation. And if you think carefully about it, if we have a cubical arrangement and we just look at the nearest neighbors, so this is now going to be the plane. So we're going to have a dipole there, a dipole there, a dipole there, a dipole there. We're going to have one above and one below. The ones above and below are going to make something that is 4p, and then we're going to have 4p down from these four neighbors. You buy that? A little bit louder?
4p down from where?
So we said that if you're to the side of the dipole, it's going to be down 1p. And here's X marks the spot. So we're going to have four, if we have a cubical array, these four guys are going to be just like this, and they're going to make an electric field that's down. The guy that's above them and the guy that's below them, they're going to make electric fields that are up but and twice as big. And the sum of all of that is zero.
Why are they twice as big?
That's how it came out, right? And it came out because this term here was, in the end, was just P. So we had 3p minus p, or 2p. I don't know, are you happy with that?
I think my issue is that I don't know what's up arrow, p, and down arrow, and up arrow.
Yeah.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, so,
okay.
I don't know if that's what it is or not. So these guys at the end, each one of them made an electric field that was down into the page that had magnitude P. The ones that are above, each one of them is going to make an electric field that's up and has magnitude 2P.
Oh, that's just, we're talking 3D.
Yeah, so this is a plane, so I'm looking at an actual cubical array, three dimensions. Okay, so what I'm hoping to convince you is that, you know, my assumption, you know, that these things are going to add up to zero, I don't know, maybe yes, maybe no. I hope I've convinced you that if we actually have something like a liquid where these guys are randomly arrayed, the electric field is certainly going to be zero that they produce. If we had a spherically symmetrical array, it's going to produce zero. But the cancellation isn't perfectly clear. It turns out in this cubic array, you can also show that all of them would add up to zero. But for other lattices, that's not going to be the case. So inside a solid with some particular geometrical arrangement of the ions, not necessarily. Okay, so we're good for gases, we're good for liquids, we're good for things like sodium chloride, which has a cubical arrangement of atoms, but there are lots of other ways that solids, the lattice in solids, can be arranged. And for those, it's not necessarily zero. But sure makes the equations easier to get rid of them. Okay, so with this proviso that things in solids are a little bit complicated, we're still going to go with the flow, right, with our basic equation that the electric field that a molecule sees is the macroscopic electric field that we've been seeing, plus the polarization divided by 3 epsilon naught. Okay. So what we want to talk about now are atomic properties. So if I take an atom and I put it in an electric field, typically it's going to polarize. There will be a relationship between its dipole moment and the corresponding electric field. So this is the atomic polarizability of an atom. And I don't know, you can calculate it in quantum mechanics next year if you want. And we'll make some kind of crude estimates of it in a second. I want to make sure that I didn't want to have an epsilon naught in there or something. Nope, I didn't want to have an epsilon naught. Okay, so what is going to be the polarization for our substance? Well, it's going to depend on how many atoms there are, right? I can calculate what the dipole moment of each atom is by putting in the electric field that it sees and multiplying it by alpha. But to get the polarization, the capital P, I need to take the dipole moment of every atom and multiply it by the number of atoms per unit volume. Sometimes called the number density. Okay, so if we work this out, the polarization should equal the dipole moment that we have times the number of particles per unit volume. And the dipole moment, we've said, is going to be alpha times the electric field that the molecule sees. And the electric field that the molecule sees is the macroscopic electric field plus the polarization divided by 3 epsilon naught. Say again?
Overhead's one. This has nothing to do with overhead. The whole meeting for overhead
to overhead. Oh, yeah. Yeah, 8 to 3. So maybe you're changing your mind now. Okay, so this is an equation that's got E's and P's. Remember, we had the macroscopic equation that the polarization was equal to the susceptibility times epsilon naught times the macroscopic E. So I ought to be able to rearrange this equation and learn what the susceptibility is in terms of the atomic property alpha. Right, all you have to do is rearrange things a little bit. Okay, so we can kind of plug and chug on this. So if we kind of put things together, let me divide everything by alpha n. So we're going to get P times 1 over alpha n. And then when we bring this over to the other side of the equation, it's going to be minus 3 over epsilon naught. All of that is going to equal the macroscopic electric field. And if we kind of rearrange this one more time, the polarization is going to be 1 over alpha n minus 3 over epsilon naught times E. And this coefficient better be equal to chi times epsilon naught. That's going to be our relationship between the atomic property alpha and the macroscopic susceptibility, which we can measure.
That whole thing, not just the denominator, right?
Yeah, that whole thing. So if we work this out, try and solve for that parameter, maybe the first thing to do is going to be to divide everything by epsilon naught. So we're going to get an epsilon naught in the denominator here. So we're going to get 1 over epsilon naught alpha n minus 1/3 is equal to chi. And if we rearrange things a little bit, we're going to get 1 over chi is equal to epsilon naught over alpha n minus 1/3. And bring that 1/3 over to this side of the equation. So we're going to get 1 over chi plus 1/3. is equal to epsilon naught over alpha n. And almost finally, alpha itself is going to equal epsilon naught over n. And then we've got 1 over chi plus 3. Certainly looks pretty ugly. So let's rearrange it a little bit. So if we multiply everything by 3 times chi, so we're going to get 3 times chi divided by chi plus 3. And I don't know, maybe that looks a little bit better if you remember that chi is just the dielectric constant minus 1. So what we're going to have here is 3 epsilon naught divided by n, 3 k minus 1 divided by k plus 2. Okay, so the point of all of this is just to make an immediate connection between things that we can measure macroscopically, dielectric constants. So you can measure dielectric constants, for example, by measuring the capacitance of capacitors that have that have their spacing filled with that dielectric, and atomic properties like the polarizability of the atom. Say again?
I think you have one too many threes.
So this is the three that's suspect? Oh, I see. No, I've got that one in there twice. Thanks. So if you just kind of think about it crudely, what you would expect is the atomic property alpha should be proportional to chi itself. So it's the fact that we have these chi's in the denominator that is the result of this fact that the molecular field wasn't equal to the macroscopic electric field. Okay, so if you look at the homework, it makes the comment here that we can compare the result from, so let me say one more thing, I guess, about this.
Up more?
This alpha is an atomic property, so it shouldn't change depending upon the pressure, for example, on the material. Right? The pressure is going to push things closer together, but it shouldn't change how a atom responds to a electric field. So that's kind of the upshot of this. What we have are data for dielectric constants at different pressure and hence different number density. And if we calculate this quantity, we should get the same thing. It shouldn't depend on the external pressure. Naively, if you're just kind of thinking about it, you would guess that the atomic property is directly proportional to chi, as opposed to having these chi's in the denominator. And so they say you can compare what you would get from the correct equation to the proportionality that you would get if you just had a k minus 1. Yeah. I'm not sure I've convinced you about anything. Okay, so what's an estimate for the polarizability of an atom? And it's going to be a somewhat crude estimate, but it's not all bad. So in quantum mechanics, you'll learn that atoms are complicated, but we haven't reached that yet. So here is our atom. Our atom consists of a ball of charge that is the cloud of the electron. Okay, so here we have an electron cloud. And the big approximation I'm making is that it has a constant density. Okay, and that's not the case. The electron cloud gets less dense as you move away from the nucleus in kind of an exponential fashion. But here we're going to have a constant density and some fixed radius for our atoms. Atoms don't have radii right there. They don't have edges. They're made out of cloud. And we've got a nucleus sitting here in the center. So our nucleus is going to have Z protons in it. And so it's going to have a positive charge that is Z times the unit of charge. if we put this atom in an electric field, what's going to happen? Well, the cloud is going to move one way because it's made out of electrons. Ooh, I overstated how much I wanted it to move. And the nucleus is going to move the other way. Right? The positive charge moves in the direction of the electric field. The negative charge moves in the opposite direction of the electric field. So we now have a off-center nucleus because we pushed things in different directions. Say a little bit louder. Yeah, that's where I kind of misdrew my thing. So I would like to shift that picture over so that the average didn't move.
Oh, okay.
But I didn't do that.
And what's after that, Z?
So this is E. This is the charge on so-called elementary charge, 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19th coulombs. I think 4.8 times something ESUs, if you really care. Okay, so we now have a dipole, right? The dipole depends on how much charge separation there have been. So let me call how far the nucleus moved over to the right, x. So this dipole is going to be the charge separation, which is z times e times x. So all we need to do is to find out an equation for what x is. Well, why does the nucleus stop moving? Well, it stops moving because there's no net electric field on it anymore, right? So the external electric field is going to be pushing it this way, but the cloud of electrons is going to make an electric field that's pushing it the other way. And it's easy to calculate what the electric field is due to this cloud of electrons, because it's just a constant density charged object, right? And we've been doing that for a long time with Gauss's law. So the electric field inside a charged object, if we just set the electric flux, the electric field times the surface area of the Gaussian surface, equal to the enclosed charge, which is the charge density times the volume of that Gaussian surface, all divided by epsilon naught, what we end up with is the electric field is going to be, well, it's easiest to express the result in terms of the total charge, right? So that means kind of multiplying and dividing this by r cubed. So if we do that, the electric field is going to be the total charge on the sphere divided by 4 pi epsilon naught, and then r divided by r cubed. You can see, I hope, that it should be proportional to r because we've got r squared there and the other r on that side. Okay, so when this electric field due to the electron clouds is equal and opposite to the external electric field, that's when the process is going to stop. Okay, so if we just rearrange that, then the amount of charge separation, which above I called x is going to be equal to the external electric charge, and then we've got, the external electric field, and then we're going to have our 4 pi epsilon naught r cubed divided by the total charge that we've got, which is, of course, z times e. Okay, so far so good. So if we put that in for x, the total charge is going to cancel, and the produced dipole is going to be the external electric field, and then what's left over is going to be 4 pi epsilon naught r cubed.
And then on the bottom is
Q. So that's the total charge, which is the atomic number times E. And I'm going to rewrite this a little bit. So I'm going to write this as epsilon naught times 4/3 pi r cubed. And I put in that extra 3, so I better better bring it back. So this is, of course, the volume that is atom. And what we can see here is that alpha is equal to epsilon naught 3 times the volume of the atom. And if we go back to kind of the simple version of the polarization equation, so if we, for the time being, just ignore the fact that the electric field isn't the electric field here isn't equal to the external electric field. So the polarization was alpha times the number of particles per unit volume times the electric field. And this quantity, alpha times n, was equal to epsilon naught chi. So what we've got then is alpha times n, epsilon naught chi. And on the other hand, over here, it's epsilon naught 3 times the volume times n. And you can see that the epsilons not cancel. And our crude approximation is that chi is going to equal 3 times the volume that is atom times the number of atoms per volume. And remember, that's what I said a long time ago, that roughly speaking, chi was the fraction of space that is atom. Right? So if we take the number of atoms and multiply it by the volume of an atom, we get the total volume of atoms divided by the total volume that is everything. And roughly speaking, chi is going to be that. Okay, so the upshot of that is just we have a good explanation for why chi is pretty big, 2, 3, 4, 5 for any old solid. And chi is going to be small for anything like a gas that is relatively dilute. So it, yeah, I would say it's the volume that is atoms. It's the number of atoms times the volume of a atom divided by the total volume. So it's the fraction of space that is atom. And it's a crude model. Atoms don't actually have volume, but the explanation is why is chi 2, 3, 4 for typical solids and small for gases. That's our only purpose. We would never put numbers in there and expect to get out an answer that was correct to within a factor of 2. Okay, so far we've been talking about atoms that produce dipoles because they are put in an electric field, so we get this charge separation of the nucleus going one way and the electrons going the other. That's not what we've been talking about. We've been talking about water, right? So water has what's called a permanent dipole moment. The oxygen likes electrons, the protons have lost some of their electrons, and so we have a net dipole moment that is there even in the absence of an electric field. So this is in contrast to this charge separation where the nucleus goes off center because we put in an electric field. Okay, so this might be called intrinsic dipole moment and this might be called induced dipole moment. So what's the story for materials like this that have a built-in electric dipole moment? Well, of course, under normal situations, those water molecules are just randomly oriented, and so there's no polarization. But when we supply an electric field, there's an energy advantage in pointing in the direction of the electric field. Right? The potential energy of a dipole is minus P dot E. So said differently, here's our picture of a dipole, plus and minus. If we put this in an electric field, the positive charge is going to want to go in the direction of the electric field. The negative charge is going to want to go in the other direction. So there is a torque that is going to try and twist those dipoles so that they align with the electric field. So when we apply an electric field, what was randomly oriented dipoles is going to be partially oriented in the direction of the electric field. why don't they all just go into the lowest energy state, right? So if I have a ball that's sitting on the hill, I mean, it might oscillate for a while, but we expect it's going to end up at the bottom of the hill. So why don't all of the dipoles, the water dipoles, all align with the electric field? We haven't gotten to stat mech yet, huh? Well, so there's an important mantra which you should be familiar with. It's not exactly relevant to this problem, but it's important enough to think about. And that is that high temperatures destroy composites. Okay, so if you take steak and throw it in the sun, what's going to happen is the complex proteins that are steak are going to be broken apart into individual atoms, and where the temperature is hot enough, the atoms are going to be ionized. We're going to break apart those composites at high enough temperatures. And there are a couple of ways of thinking about this. I think probably for most of you, the most convenient way to think about this is just that high temperatures are kind of a sign of kinetic energy. So if you've got lots of energy, random energy flowing around, some of that energy can be used to break things apart. So for the people who are taking stat mech, they know that equation, don't they? Not yet? You got to know your famous dead physicists. This is Gibbs. Kyle certainly knows who Gibbs is.
I've seen that.
Why does he know?
Say again?
Why does he know?
Yeah, it's base rock chemistry. Well, no, it's not. It's thermal physics that the chemists use frequently. Got to get our nomenclature right. Gibbs was definitely a physicist, not a chemist. And there are a bunch of other famous dead thermodynamicists who are also physicists, like Maxwell, actually. Who else deserves naming here? Calvin?
Calvin.
Oh yeah. Everyone who's good is a physicist. Except, you know, JC himself, right? I'm not sure that JC knew Maxwell's equations. So what every physicist should know, and what I actually teach the 105ers for that matter, is that for a reaction to go, so we know that things go downhill in energy. Yeah. And really, things go downhill with Gibbs free energy. That is to say, if Gibbs free energy is negative, then the reaction can go. If Gibbs free energy is positive, it can't go. And what's important here, so the delta H is, approximately speaking, the internal energy, although it's not really the internal energy. You don't really want, so this is enthalpy. Have you done enthalpy? So you know that it's not really the internal energy, but it's okay. It's pretty much internal energy. So as we increase the temperature, changes in entropy become more and more important, and in a negative sense, and negative is downhill. So obviously breaking stuff apart makes a lot more entropy, and so it becomes increasingly important at high temperatures. Okay, so I don't know, pick your favorite way to think about this. But high temperatures correspond to disrupting what would otherwise occur, to breaking apart composites. So there's kind of a balance that occurs. The dipoles would like to align with the electric field, but they're always going to be bounced around by thermal effects, by this kinetic energy that is always available. And I guess another famous dead physicist who I'm about to mention who deserved to be on this list was Boltzmann. And we all remember Boltzmann's factor, right? From 370. So, approximately speaking, the probability of something happening is proportional to e to the minus energy that you're talking about divided by kT, where this is Boltzmann's constant, the temperature in absolute units, and the energy. Okay, so if we have a really negative energy, if we have a real negative, if we have a real downhill possibility, then this is going to be e to a big number, and so we're going to have a big probability. If you're talking about, you know, jumping Empire State Building in a single leak, if you have a big positive energy, then it's going to be a real low probability event. So the result is that at high temperatures, well, let me phrase it differently, at low temperatures, then getting into the lowest energy state is really important. Because that same energy will be divided by a smaller number and it'll be an overall probability. Okay, so if we throw this all in, if we calculate the average value of one of these dipoles, what we need to do is basically add up the probability of any particular configuration times the z component that we're going to get, and then divide it by the sum of those probabilities. And these sums are going to become integrals, and this is something that these guys will be doing, I guess, in a month or so. The upshot of this is that if you make a plot of the average value of the dipole that's aligned with the electric field versus, I'll say versus the electric field to start with, what happens is for small electric fields, a very small fraction of the dipoles are aligned because they're mostly being disrupted by these thermal effects. But if I put a strong enough electric field in, I can eventually get 100% of them pushed in the direction of the electric field. And really what matters is the electric field divided by the temperature. Right? So the same electric field at low temperature can also 100% polarize the water. And kind of the important factoid is that under normal situations, we're always pretty much in this linear region. So the possibility of 100% polarizing water really doesn't occur, unless you're at a few degrees above absolute zero. And under those circumstances, then this slope, this relationship between the average value of the dipole and temperature is given by the following, right? So it's the dipole moment squared 3, and then the electric field, sorry for the two things, this was that was electric field, divided by kT. And if you want, you can kind of think about this as we get a fraction of the intrinsic electric dipole moment, and then in a ratio that is the energy, right? The energy is going to depend on the dot product of P and E, and so has a kind of size that is the dipole moment times E, what that is in relationship to the temperature. So you can kind of look at this final factor as the ratio of the energy that you would get if you were aligned divided by the commonly available energy that's there just because there's a temperature. The subscript? Yeah, so those are all zeros, and they're just standing for the intrinsic dipole moment of the water molecule. And the reason there's a naught there is, if you think about it, a water molecule can do two things. There's no reason it can't be polarized by the electric field. I mean, its nucleus can get stretched out too. So its atomic dipole moment is going to both depend on aligning its dipole with this external electric field and having its nuclei stretched away. So we can distinguish an intrinsic dipole moment from one that's induced due to the electric field. Okay, so kind of a few more words. So you all, I hope, you know, you've all run into permanent magnets, or had them run into you, one or the other. Those things are called ferromagnetic materials. The equivalent thing for electrical materials are called ferroelectric. And there's nothing, the ferro, of course, stands for iron, but there's nothing that is particularly ironish about the electric. It's just that this is analogy to how permanent magnets work. So these are materials where, without an external electric field, these dipoles can be pushed in one direction. Okay, and that's exactly how permanent magnets work, except these are magnetic dipole moments that are permanently aligned. There are no simple examples. None whose names I could ever recall. They're pretty complicated molecules usually. The ones I can barely remember, I think, have titanium in them and oxygen and maybe some other stuff. So they're not common. And they're typically not particularly useful. That is to say, that's maybe an overstatement. For permanent magnets, of course, what's nice is you're going to get a nice north and a south pole that you can use. If you take a ferroelectric material, you're going to end up with a positive bound charge density and a negative bound charge density. But, you know, stuff will come from the universe and it'll cancel that. So you'll end up with exactly canceling negative charge from the universe and positive charge there, and now your ferroelectric is not a source of electric field anymore. Though there is charge in the universe and it'll accumulate there. It'll be, whereas that can't happen with a magnet, right? There aren't south poles that are floating around in the universe that can sit on top of this north pole to cancel it out. So, I mean, there are a variety of reasons that ferroelectrics aren't nearly as important as ferromagnetic materials, but that's one of them. If you think about how this should happen for magnetic materials, if I have high enough temperature, I should disrupt these dipoles. And so it turns out that there's a temperature called the Curie temperature, not for Madame, but for her husband, Perry? I'm not sure how to pronounce his first name. So at this temperature, materials that have their dipoles aligned become unaligned. And the temperature at which that happens is called the Curie temperature. And these ferroelectric materials have that same sort of property, that their special electric property would disappear at high enough temperatures. What else did I want to say? And the last thing I wanted to say is a complicated story, and you're going to hear it again, but you want to hear it multiple times. Hysteresis.
Sounds like a lab.
So hysteresis is where things depend on history. So if we make a plot, and I'm going to talk about this magnetically, but it applies exactly electrically too. If I take a piece of material and I subject it to a ferromagnetic material, I subject it to a magnetic field. As I subject it to it, it starts to get magnetized. If I turn off the magnetic field, it doesn't go back to unmagnetized. It goes back to some certain amount of magnetization. If I now turn on a backwards magnetic field, I can saturate it in the other direction. And if I turn off my magnetic field, I end up with it not at zero, but at some finite amount of magnetization. And so there are these things that are called hysteresis loops that basically define this magnetic behavior. So it's actually pretty hard to unmagnetize them. And one of the ways of doing it is to have very fast oscillations that decrease in amplitude. So we're going around in these hysteresis loops that are smaller and smaller and smaller until finally we're back at zero.
What lab do we have to try to work
with that? So in lots of labs, we talked about where the data collection depended on the temperature, on the history of taking the data. And the context was the temperature of the device. That is to say, when we were heating it up, it was always a little bit colder than when we were cooling it down. So even when we had the same current going through it, it wasn't at the same temperature. So the generic word when things depend on history is this word hysteresis, which has its origin in this magnetic phenomena. Okay, so on next time to chapter 6, where we talk about energy and electric fields.